Thank you. Phil G from Pitt and Sherry. My question is to either Kevin or in the relationship between the independent water authorities and land use planning.
I'll go first on that. Interestingly, in our past history, it used to be that we would have discussions about where development areas would occur and we would try and force development into certain areas. But when we became corporatised, the focus was that we became indifferent to where development occurs. In fact, we welcome development wherever it occurs as long as they can pay the right price for it. So when a developer comes to us, we have location-based pricing where you pay, if you've got a subdivision of 200 houses and we've got capacity in dams and treatment plants, you'll just pay a proportional cost of what it costs for new growth. Now, what happens in that model is that when developers come to us and they're remote areas or they're a long way out of town, we're happy for that to go ahead, but we tell them what it costs, and they often come back and say, do you realise it's cheaper to develop in the city than it is further out of town? And we say, yeah, that's the way it works. And then they do their sums on buying cheaper blocks of cheaper land out of the city and higher costs for water and sewerage versus more expensive blocks closer to the city but lower water and sewerage. They do their business model and then they come back and tell us what they want to do. We say to every developer, we can put water and sewer on, and then it's a discussion with the councils. It's easy.
Thanks, Phil. Well, certainly in our situation, we have a very good relationship with the local government units in our region. We have input into their planning strategies and planning reviews from time to time. We are a referral authority in terms of provision of water and sewage services to new businesses and subdivisions and so forth might come before a particular local government unit. Prior to the establishment of the Essential Services Commission in Victoria, we had a very similar approach to what Kevin's just outlined based on location-based costing, whereby if a development was a long way out of town, the cost of the developer were going to be significantly higher in terms of, or if it was a long way from the water supply, for instance, in terms of headworks charge and so forth. But we got stitched up by the Essential Services Commission in the first price review. And those location-based charges for headworks across Victoria, including the City of Melbourne, were slashed from multiple thousands of dollars in some cases to a uniform price of $500. Since our first price review, the regulator has left the state, thank Christ, and we have a much more sensible regulator these days who has a water industry background. And so in the next price review, which we're currently in the early stages of now, which will water plans will be public documents in the next few weeks. We've managed to claw that back significantly and we'll have a much more location-based incentive process to help us to get developed to occur where the infrastructure can be provided the most efficiently.
I might just add one comment that if you look on our website, you'll see the location-based pricing. So if developers want to know that in advance, they can just look where they're looking at land and they can get a feel for what it costs. It helps them with their feasibility studies.
Thank you. The gentleman over there.
Yeah, my name's Robert Rockefeller. This is a question to Kevin Young from Hunter Water. We're a user of your services in Newcastle, and I have spruced Hunter Water to many people in Tasmania over the years, and I've actually said for them to go and visit your website because I think they'd be absolutely astounded how water and wastewater is managed. What I'd like you to inform the audience on is a water bill and what it consists of and how you charge. And that I'd like, while the focus of many people is actually on water and water meters, I'd like you to actually focus on the wastewater side of that bill and also in terms of grease traps and grease arresters and how do you charge for effluent and those types of things. Because I think many people will be surprised at the closed-loop system you have and the sophistication of it.
Water's pretty simple. We've always had a philosophy that the fixed charge should be very low, and so it's probably only about $30, $40 for a customer on water, and most of it's volumetric. So as Professor Friedman said, if you use less water, you save water. If you use a lot of water, it's expensive. On the wastewater side, we have a combination of fixed charge and volumetric charge, so a proportion of what you use going through your water meter is also calculated volumetric from the wastewater side of the business. So if you save water, you save on the wastewater side as well. It's the same price for a residential customer as it is for a business. We couldn't see any reason why a commercial or industrial should pay more for the service than a householder would. But it's based on the common principle of that a industrial customer is discharging domestic waste, because that's the way we set our pricing. So if you've got a customer like a restaurant or a major industrial user that's got high-strength waste, they form a trade waste permit with us and they pay costs for analysis of their waste. And if they haven't got a grease trap in or they're not doing pre-treatment, well, they're discharging higher than domestic strength, and therefore our waste charges come in. Waste charges for BOD and phosphorus and grease and oil. And that is back to that business to say this is user pays and this is what it costs, because the charge that everyone pays is based on domestic. Now, in a lot of those cases, those businesses have said, we think we understand this now and we're putting grease traps in and we're putting in pre-treatment. It's, again, it's just all business principles, but they do the maths, and they do the maths on the basis if they put these things in place, then their charges drop, and then that pays for their investment. But, again, it's a user pays system, and we watch that like a hawk, because if they're putting in waste that's too high or that we're finding some difficulties with, then that flows through to our biosolids and we have difficulty reusing it, and that's one of the things we want to do. So that we've got some limits that we just will not accept from a private sector, or they just can't connect to our system.
Our pricing principles are almost identical to what Kevin's just described, that residential and non-residential consumers are charged on the same basis as residential usage, consumption costs, etc. But once we get into the quality and the strength of the waste, those charges increase for non-residential customers. The only comment I would like to add to is, I didn't perhaps say in my presentation, that in that when we established Golden Valley Water, we had a tariff schedule as long as this table, I guess, from all the businesses that became part of Golden Valley Water. And over time, we've been able to what we call harmonise those prices and reduce postage stamp pricing across the region, so that everyone today pays exactly the same price for their water and sewage services. It's $110 fixed fee, and that will be fixed now for a service fee, I should say. That will be fixed in the next regulatory period. We don't intend to increase that. The volumetric price for water this financial year is 59 cents a kilolitre for everyone in the region, and that will increase our future price rises. We'll be focused on the volumetric side, not the fixed pricing. And the residential customers pay $258 flat fee for their sewage services this financial year. So it has been able to be achieved with minimal impact, really, on the larger centres, with the cost being harmonised across the business.
Thank you. The gentleman over here.
Rodney Cameron Tucker from the Australian Medical Association. I'd like to congratulate the Treasurer for raising the issues of public health. Clearly the AMA, as this debate has been unfolding, has concerns about the 5,000 Tasmanians who are on boiling water alert, and also the issue with sewage. And through the ongoing debate, we'll be entering into the public discourse about the public consequences of not doing this reform. I suppose the other issue that we're also interested in, and excuse me for pointing out the slide, but we're talking about not Michael Arid, but waterproofing the system. So my question really is also, other than the reform, is there going to be a sufficient supply of water to the smaller communities from the areas that have an excess of water, which is a major infrastructure development down the track? And to the first speaker, who suggested that water was just a commodity that was not essential for life and should be costed in a certain fashion. We don't do health in that way. The federal government provides a common level of health with equity across the nation as well as it can. And if it was a user pay system, then we would be possibly back looking at the African model of health system. which is clearly not the one that we want. So to the Treasurer, thank you for raising the health issues. We're looking at that quite deliberately, and also we're looking at the issue of sustainable water supply to a growing regions and certainly our smaller towns where our general practitioners operate. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Are there any more questions? Well, while you're thinking up yours, I'll use one. This is for Professor Freeburn or Minister Ed. If council are concerned that losing water and wastewater services will affect their financial viability, what are some of the market design options available to address this concern as part of the reform agenda?
Well, I think it's the point that both Laurie and Kevin have made. If you charge water as a commodity and you use user pays fees, you're basically going to at least break even over time. And you've also got to recognise that these investments have long lives. So I see no problem in going to the market and borrowing the $1 billion that the Treasurer is talking about, paying market rates, and setting your user fees such that over time it gets repaid. Again, this is a story about water ain't all that different to other products. Yes, health's got some funny stories. But by and large, think about dentistry. Dentistry is treated pretty much like a regular product. And it's not clear that the dentistry system is any better or worse than the hospital GP system. My view actually is that if you build into your water price an opportunity value for what it's worth to the environment, which you should, then water authorities are going to collect much more than is necessary to collect to cover all their infrastructure expenditure stuff. I think there's a much more intriguing argument then about whether there's an appropriate resource rent tax on these water corporations. Not a kind of a blind state government fleecing money. The Treasurer was quite proud to say that wouldn't happen in Tasmania, but it clearly happens in a couple of the other states. And I think part of the debate is to think about the appropriate pricing structure, who owns it, and who shares some of these rents. But the key thing is, I think, is you running water as a business with user pays fees, the dollars will essentially look after themselves.
I mean, the issue for local government and that's... I agree that the market would determine that. The issue at the moment is about the level of investment that is going into... Alan described it quite well, I mean, in terms of the dilemma and the issue that we have to address with local government in the immediate short term, because some councils are not seen to be viable as it is in some areas. And to not have an income stream over a period of time is going to put them in a less viable position than they are presently. And so I think that in any move to a model, a regional model or a state entity, there would have to be some smoothing, and that would require some funds. And I do see a role perhaps for the federal government in this, given the structural changes that we're trying to achieve, to provide some smoothing on the way, on the way through as we move to structural reform.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you, over here.
Yeah, Mike Graver on behalf of the Property Council, and I think it's a question for the Treasurer. I guess we've heard two types of presentations today, and the first has been around issues that we're facing in Tasmania, some of the background to what's happened and where we are today, and then presentations from our interstate colleagues saying, basically, been there, done that, bought the T-shirt, that's where we were 15 years ago, and we've gone on a journey, we've made some fundamental change, we've got some really good outcomes out of that. Therefore, Do we need to continue to procrastinate, or do we need to get on and make some change? Do we need to get Jeff Kennett Consulting for Proprietary Limited down here?
Is he still around?
To set us on a journey. And what is the forward plan and pathway and perhaps time frame to address some of this change?
Well, thank you very much. It'd be good to have John Patterson down here for a little while. He'd made me look terrific. Jeff Kennett lost the next election.
That's very true.
And Tony Rundle tried something similar, and he lost an election. And I'm not about to cut off my nose to spite my face. I think that we have made progress over the past 9 months in terms of the discussion, and the fact that we're having this meeting today and this discussion, we are making progress. And that I'm heartened by Alan's comments today, and I have been heartened by other comments coming from local government, West Tamar being the exception. Well, I do think it's a bit ridiculous that, you know, water and sewage reform is going to pay for a hospital. I find that a bit intriguing as a notion. But I think that we will now have to sit down with local government, and I think they are prepared to get on board now in some form of reform. And that, as I indicated, one of the interesting things in Parliament during the estimates period is that Will Hodgman is here today, and Peg Putt, as leader of the Greens, agreed that the status quo is not acceptable. So we are making progress. Anyone who knows the type of personality I am, I want to do everything today, but I am also patient, and I know that I need to take people along to get the types of reforms we're seeking. And local government is obviously a major stakeholder in that, and that, that's why I've indicated that we'll be sitting down and having some more detailed discussions about how we achieve that reform.
I'd just like to make a comment on those T-shirts. There was lots of blood, and they were fairly well ripped at the end of it, and it wasn't just the governments that suffered. I think the sort of reform that we're talking about in those states was done swiftly and with lots of pain, and while it got a lot of beneficial outcomes that we can look back on a decade after and say that was a good outcome, and we can measure those outcomes, people's lives are thrown into turmoil, communities were thrown into turmoil, and I think what we're about is, yes, those things were done, yes, there's good outcomes, but there's better ways to do it having a look at a decade in hindsight. So we're for reform, but we think there's a better way to do it than the way Jeff Kennett did it.
Thank you. The Speaker, over to you.
I was just going to add one comment on that. I agree with all that. I think the only question is, what's the time period of churn that you put up with? Because it's a bit unnerving being in a time of churn in organisations, and sometimes that's more fearful than the outcome, just not knowing what the outcome is. So I agree that the process we went through was very fast and quick, and you know, everyone looks back now and says, wasn't that a great thing? You can take more time, and that's probably appropriate, but if you take too much time, then that can be destructive in itself, because, you know, everyone's thinking, well, what is the future and where am I? So it's a process you've got to just keep moving ahead and making progressive steps.
Thanks, Kevin. Sorry, now.
Thank you. My name's John Dannenberg. I'm representing the Planning Institute of Australia. The community has been encouraged, certainly in the last 2 years or so, to be working towards drought-proofing Australia. I'd like to address my question to the two managers of the water authorities, and possibly to the Treasury, might want to comment. As commercial suppliers of water to the community, are you supportive, indifferent, or antagonistic to people installing water tanks and collecting water for their own purposes?
Certainly happy to answer that question. Certainly, we in Victoria, we actually provide rebates to urban community people who install rainwater tanks in a reticulated area. I think it's $500 at the present time. I certainly don't, as an individual, I certainly don't advocate strongly the installation of rainwater tanks per se. because I think they're very hard to fit into the long-term planning of infrastructure for a city or a region in terms of just how much water they'll capture. Do people continue to maintain and continue to use them? Some people will, some people won't. Plus, they're also a fairly expensive option in terms of other options available to securing our water supply. And certainly in our region where we have low rainfall, particularly during the summertime when you actually need most of the water out of a rainwater tank system for domestic use, it takes about, based on current pricing, it would take at least 30 years to recover the cost of a 2,000 litre rainwater tank and pumping system to use that water within your house. And that's not recognising the cost of your capital in the first place, but it'd take you about 30 years to get your money back.
I think from a Hunter perspective, interesting, when Patterson came in, we had a chart on the wall and it had the next 10 dams that we were going to build. And in the order that we were going to build them, and I think Patterson with User Pays was saying, look, there's a cost for supply, and you can convert that to a cost per kilolitre, but there's also a cost to constrain demand, things like rainwater tanks or even user pricing. And so you should do what's the best for the community in that area, and it depends on what your situation is, supply versus demand. In New South Wales, it's a bit of a government policy issue because all new houses in New South Wales have to have a rainwater tank of a certain size plumbed into the house to have toilet flushing and for laundry, unless you've got access, which a lot of our customers are getting, to recycled water, highly treated recycled water plumbed through their subdivision to use for irrigation, toilet flushing and garden watering. Rainwater tanks is one of those things for me, we provide a rebate, only $650, but the levelised cost of rainwater tanks turns out to be about $3 or $4 a kilolitre, which is quite expensive. The other thing with rainwater tanks, if you use it for toilet flushing and garden watering, you want it to be available on tap all the time, so you've got to have a pump installed, and some of the work we see coming out of that can mean higher energy use per home compared to the normal supply. And so for a climate change future, you've got to weigh up both energy and water. But yeah, we're after what's the best for the community, not just a supply focus. If we can spend money to constrain demand and that frees up growth, the new IPART rules, the developer model, are that if that frees up money, frees up capacity for growth, then growth can pay for some of that demand management costs. It's just a simple system.
Can I just add to that? There are issues on both the supply side and the demand side. If you think of water running into dams, then the great feature of Australia is the huge variability of rainfall. What's interesting is about some of the new supply sources of water, desal and recycling, have much greater reliability. And so water suppliers are thinking about portfolios of water with different degrees of variability. And on the other side of the story is on the demand. You and I, for drinking water and showers, and industry wants a regular supply. Perennial crops require a fairly regular supply. But annual crops can opportunistically hop in and out. So, in fact, it may actually be really good to have rice and cotton, but they're only grown in years where there's lots of water, and when water's scarce, they go out of business. It also makes interesting questions about environmental flows. Do we allocate a constant percentage of the flow year in, year out, or a constant flow? Or does the environment act as more a opportunistic buyer? And at least on places like the Murray Darling, the pristine world was opportunistic. So we have to think on both the demand and the supply side about how we come to grips with this variability. And it's really suggesting we need different property rights. Some for high security, high guarantee, quite costly. Another set of property rights which are sort of lower priority, and they'll be picked up by the annual crops, and maybe many of us who want gardens will decide we'll be opportunistic.
Thank you.
I've got a question in relation to the resource rent concept that Professor Fairbairn raised, And I'm wondering, it's probably a question to Laurie, Kevin and John, in relation to the allocation of water and the determination of resource rents for competing uses, particularly community, agricultural irrigation, for instance, power in our case, and also ecosystem services, should there be a separation of powers between the water businesses and the organisation that determines resource rents, or should we be moving towards a system where the water business manages a catchment on a full water cycle management basis, including the determination of what the resources were?
Well, the short answer is you want to separate those things.
Yeah, I agree too.
You know, it's a bit like regulation and provision. You don't put Dracula in charge of the blood bank. You know, that's the sort of thing that a government treasurer should do. And he or she sets the rules on which these water corporations operate. And then you're much more likely to get the right outcome.
Yeah, I'd agree with that too. I think that the separation's good. It's an interesting tension and balance between economic regulators and monopoly suppliers, and that delivers value if that's in good balance and works well. It raises some issues. We pay, the state owns all the water in our state, and so they sell water and same price. Well, it used to be different. Irrigators would buy water cheaper than the water businesses would, but they're getting parity in that moving forward to more cost-reflective pricing. If there was a resource rent, I don't think I'd like to be in the business of setting it. I think it's more of an economic regulator, and I'm happy to collect it, and then the question is, how do you spend it?
That's my job.
Yeah, that's your job, exactly. That's a treasurer's job to decide that.
Yes, certainly in Victoria these roles are separated. We have some 12 catchment management authorities which have been established at the same time as the water industry was reformed, and they're responsible for the management of the catchments and all that public good side of the environmental aspects of water, as quite distinct from the commercial aspects of taps and toilets, if you like. But we certainly have a very rigorous water framework now in the Goulburn Valley system in particular, and pretty much right across Victoria where water is allocated. We do have bulk entitlements between urban water utilities such as ourselves. Irrigators have their entitlement and the environment has their entitlement, so the Goulburn and the Murray systems. We have a very active water market, a very mature active water market, and we're able to trade that water between consumptive use and irrigation in particular. And certainly the availability of water and the climate we've recently experienced does have a significant impact on what people are prepared to pay for the price of water. And water that irrigators normally pay $40 a megalitre for in 2006 irrigation season, we traded water to them at up to $1,000 per megalitre on the market because it was so severe a shortage of water in the Goulburn and the Murray systems this last irrigation season. In terms of resource rent, we sort of have a de facto resource rent in Victoria, and my organisation makes an environmental contribution each year of $1.5 million to the Catchment Management Authority as part of the funding they get from the state government to carry out those public good aspects of looking after catchments.
Thank you. I'll make this the last question. Thank you.
Thank you. Alistair Graham, Tasmanian Conservation Trust, a local conservation NGO. Professor Freeband, I'd like to pick up on the point you made before. What kind of property rights do you think should be allocated to what kind of institutions to ensure that environmental flows are maintained in an open market? If you look at it from a fishy's point of view, with a short memory and no vote and no checkbook, you'd have to be a rather silly fish to appoint a government to represent your interests.
I wish I could actually answer that question. You know, there are various models around. One is to say, give an environmental authority a terms of reference and some water property rights, which that authority can buy and sell, and the authority then has to report to Parliament, and if Parliament, you know, they're on a five-year appointment or whatever, if they perform, Parliament lets that authority run again. If they don't, it's opened out for tender.
Other options are that you just, which is pretty much where we are now, you have in caps saying this is the maximum amount of water that can be taken out for consumptive uses, or this is the minimum amount that's got to be run down the river. And I guess we found on the mainland that when water got short for consumptive uses, promises for the environment have got stretched out and out. So I think my gut feeling is to set up an environmental authority that's properly responsible and has to monitor, give that authority some money, and let them see what they can do best. And I think what's also important is when we look into the future, as we become wealthier, I suspect we are going to demand more and more of our environment. And so the Minister for the Environment will have to go to the Expenditure Review Committee every 4 or 5 years and bid for more money to go to the authority to buy out more consumptive uses. Or they might decide it then becomes possible to invest in lining pipelines, desal or whatever.